Hello, space junkies, and welcome to What a Piece of Junk, episode number 131, where we're going to discuss Star Wars Ahsoka Part 7, Dreams and Madness. But I can't discuss Dreams and Madness without my original Wookiee co-pilot, our very own Dave Filcloney, Mr. Miracle himself, the gooey chewy man of a thousand nicknames. It is Nathan Miracle. Nathan, how's it going?
Okay, was that a subtle hint that I'm mad or a subtle hint that I'm all a dream?
I'll leave that up to the audience interpretation because that's what you do when you're Dave Filoni and you well know as Dave Filoni.
Yeah, I'm going to take it as I'm very dreamy.
Sure, I'll accept that. And you know what else was dreamy was this week's episode of Ahsoka. Although, I have to say, it was a very calm landscape in order for Baylan Skoll to look around and say Peridia was a land of dreams and madness.
Yeah.
I haven't really seen much that would lead me toward madness. Maybe dreams, insofar as from his perspective, because, you know, he has that connection to the Force where he can sort of see what's happening or what's to come, right? A little bit of precognition seems to be one of Baylan's gifts. And I think that means that when he's looking out at the landscape on Peridia, or at least when he's tapping into the Force to try and predict what is going to come next, like he does back in the Star Wars Prime Galaxy, he can't really do it out here in Peridia. And maybe he gets way more of the feeling and impression of the Night Sisters and their Dark Force magics than the average person would because of his connection to the Force in that manner. So to him, it's way more about dreams and madness than it is in the physical world that we're all looking at.
Could be. He could also be referring to the Night Sisters themselves and how they had a dream of an empire, but ultimately it was all madness. Or, you know, this could all just be a big reference to the Kingdom of Dreams and Madness, which was a 2013 documentary about Studio Ghibli, a subject about which I know frighteningly little.
Studio Ghibli, of course, a world famous anime studio that has made many anime feature films that have been very successful. And then, of course, they were also one of the animation houses that worked on Star Wars Visions that we had.
Which is why I've at least one heard of them.
Right? I think, was it season one?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
I'll have to double check that. As mentioned, I'm not as good with the whole anime studio thing as everybody else. By everybody else, I mean you and Derek, because there's only three people in the world.
Yes, totally. A world of dreams and madness. Well, anyway, Derek is unfortunately not able to be with us this week for the podcast episode. He is traveling for work, so we wish him the best, and we will try to keep the Drunken Gungan functioning properly, even though it is built for a three-man crew in the cockpit. But anyway, before we jump into the five questions for Dreams and Madness, Nathan, what's been your overall take about this episode, and maybe even your overall take on the progress of the Ahsoka series so far?
I think this might be my favorite episode so far, and a lot of it has to do with Ahsoka herself. She's not been really in every episode, for one.
Right.
And she's been kind of off-putting for a good bit of the series. We've talked about that.
She's been Mrs.
And very curt and not caring with Sabine. But in this episode, she feels like she's back to her old self. And this is really the first episode that we've seen her after she became Ahsoka the White. You know, we had the episode where she went into the World Between Worlds and had her transformation. But then immediately afterwards, they got in a whale and then Ahsoka weren't really in the next episode. So this is the first time we've really seen her back to her old self. And I really love that. Plus, we got the reconnection of Ezra, Sabine, and Ahsoka all in the same place at the same time. Our heroes have finally come together after all of this time. That was great to see. So And when we get to the connections to the other parts of the Star Wars galaxy, we've got some.
So yes, absolutely.
All of that I've loved. And that, in total, has made this my favorite episode so far.
Well, great. That's awesome. I definitely wouldn't say this was my favorite episode so far, but I really enjoyed this episode. I think still my favorite episode so far has been the one where Ahsoka and Anakin interact in the World Between Worlds. That was just a really great storytelling.
That is probably a close second for me.
Yeah.
But I really liked
Part 7. I liked Part 7 a lot. It was a lot of fun. I agree with you. There's lots of things to connect it to the rest of the Star Wars galaxy, so I can't wait for that section. I think, for me, the trajectory of the show as a whole so far has been very good as a building up of a part of a multi-season storyline. I don't think they're going to be able to answer all of the stuff that I have outstanding in my brain in this final 8th episode in order for me to say that it's a really good standalone season. But mm-hmm. I've been watching televised science fiction long enough to know that you really shouldn't judge a series based on its first season until you've gotten several more seasons taken care of. That's always a good rule of thumb with Star Trek, even though mm-hmm. network executives, for some reason, haven't learned that over the past 50 plus years. Come on, network executives that run Star Trek. Anyway, so I think I'm going to reserve judgment on the season as a whole until we get at least a season 2, which I'm almost 100% that we will get Ahsoka season 2.
Even if we don't get Ahsoka season 2 per se, we know that we're going to get the Dave Filoni movie and we're going to tie in other shows with this. So even if we don't get a season 2 before that movie, the story will continue. Oftentimes with Star Wars television shows, when we get to that last episode, we talk on here about, man, I just don't know how they're going to fit everything into that final episode. And quite often, they kind of don't.
Yeah, we said this with Andor, mm-hmm. and I know we said it with The Bad Batch.
And we said it with The Book of Boba Fett, mm-hmm. which it had weird finale.
Yeah.
But in this case, even though I've got all these questions still outstanding, I'm not expecting them to all be answered in this episode, this upcoming episode. And I think that helps.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'm going to do my best Thugs with Mugs here when I sit here and sip and listen to your answer to question number 1. Oh, nice. What was your favorite part of episode 7, which you apparently have now decreed is your favorite episode?
My favorite part of episode 7 is Ezra fighting without a lightsaber. His ally is the Force. The Force is with him. A powerful ally it is. He's using the Force for knowledge and defense. May also be killing some people, just not with a weapon. But he actually takes on somebody who is armed with a lightsaber without a lightsaber. I think that's really, really cool. Back in the original trilogy, I always felt like Palpatine was more powerful than Vader, and it's because he didn't resort to pulling out a lightsaber. When it came time for him to use the Force, he's just like, okay, you're going to die, lightning blasts.
Yep.
Didn't even know he was a Force user up until that point, because that's the first time we see him actually use the Force, is I'm going to shock you to death, because he doesn't need to display a lightsaber. Then he does use some in the Clone Wars and episode 3, but that's beside the point. He levels up between then and Return of the Jedi. So seeing Ezra not use a lightsaber and still fighting, that makes him seem really powerful in my mind. I think that was a great choice to have him do that. Plus, it allows Sabine to keep that lightsaber. It stops there from being a fight over it. She thinks it's his. He knows it's hers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that was excellent. Seeing Ezra do Force martial arts. Come on, that's so good. And it's a great nod to the Akira Kurosawa Asian samurai film influence of Star Wars, because the whole idea about ninja and martial arts, Shigaru in the first place, was for the lay people, the peasants, to have some way to compete against nefarious or evil or just exploitative samurai, the ruling class, where they had all their armor and their weapons and their awesome stuff, and you just have your farming tools or your hands and feet. But yet we think of those people, the Ashikaru, the people who fought with martial arts, as some of the greatest warriors who have ever lived. Because, as Storm Shadow once said in G.I. Joe, a true warrior is himself a weapon. So it is not that you need a lightsaber or an energy slingshot or a blaster to make a difference when you know your cause is right and you have the ability to rely upon yourself and do your martial arts. Really good stuff. I can't wait to see Ezra do more things like that. But my favorite part of this episode is on the other side of the battle. I was going to say the other side of the Force, but technically not. And it was Grand Admiral Thrawn doing Thrawn things at the end of the episode. When Morgan Elspeth is all, "But we lost!" And he was all, "Actually, we have cost Ahsoka Tano the one thing she cannot afford to lose. Time. Because while they were doing all of that stuff, we were busy loading up my super secret weapon onto the Star Destroyer, and now we're bugging out." And so, you know, I can't wait for him to unleash whatever is in those coffin thingy-ma-boops. I think we've put to rest that these guys, that the Night Troopers are zombies. I don't think they are. Not only did they die in the way that normal Stormtroopers do, they didn't appear to exhibit any otherworldly powers or abilities in their fight against our heroes. They kind of went down like chumps, almost the same way as any other random Stormtrooper or Scout Trooper or Snow Trooper or Sith Trooper or whatever. You know, when they come at you en masse and the good guys find some way to overcome the odds and beat the crap out of Stormtroopers, and the Stormtroopers, I won't say miss, because Sabine and them did have to block and hide and deflect and stuff.
And that Beskar armor is coming in handy.
It is, yeah. That's saving her life many, many times. So these Stormtroopers were as accurate as they needed to be. Just our heroes found a way to avoid any real damage, except for that one little piece of Ezra's hair. But that wasn't from a Stormtrooper. That was from Shin Hati. I loved that, by the way, him using the Force to also increase his personal speed, because it was really cool for him to do that as a dodge move when Shin herself had done a four-speed dodge earlier in this show. So for someone to use it against her was pretty cool.
And nice to see that coming back all the way from episode one, when Qui-Gon and Obi-Wan got the heck out of dodge in the hallway. And then from there on out, we didn't see force speed again for a long time. And that question always came up. Like, why don't Jedi use this all the time? I have to assume that it's a very taxing ability. And that keeps them from just always being at force speed. Or just,
I think it's,
if this is why they have such good reflexes, is they're kind of always using a low level version of it.
It's also a bit, real world wise, it's a bit like why the Flash doesn't use his super speed to the nth degree that he could in every Flash story, because otherwise we wouldn't have much of a story.
Or perhaps other fiction world.
Yes. So anyway, let's move on to question number two. What was your least favorite part of the episode?
All right. I assume we've all seen the pitch meeting videos on YouTube, where he's got the certain quotes he goes with every time. And this one really made me think of one of those when they went through the minefield and they thought that, oh man, this is going to be such a huge thing. It's going to kill us all. At least the whales are giving us some protection. Oh, they bugged out. But then it's going to be super hard for them to get through there. Actually, it's going to be super easy. Barely an inconvenience. They just go right through the minefield, come out right out the other side. It really felt like the minefield was there just to have an excuse for the whales to jump away, not to put Ahsoka and Huang in any actual danger.
Yeah.
But it was presented as though it was going to be a danger to them, and then it just wasn't.
Yeah.
That part fell a little flat for me.
Yeah, I'm very close to you on least favorite part. For me, it was Huyang expertly outflying the other fighter craft that are chasing the T-6, Ahsoka's ship. I still desperately want a name for Ahsoka's ship, but anyway. T-6, The T-6 is being chased by those cool, like, World War II Spitfire-inspired fighter craft again, which I love those starships, by the way.
Yes, I love the sound effects on them, too.
Yeah, and the rando mercenary pilots are chasing down Hu Yang. Ahsoka jumps out. Neat, awesome, you know, almost Huey attack helicopter a la Vietnam. Thank you, 1970s influence on Star Wars, where she's airborne assault jumping down to fight Baylan Skoll. That part was great. And I figured Hu Yang was going to have to just bail out and run away and come back after he loses those fighters. Nah, it's Hu Yang dogfighting time, baby. And he's like flying circles around those dudes and just blows them away.
He's got millennia of experience on them.
He's got millennia of experience building lightsabers. Do we think he has millennia of dogfighting combat pilot experience? I guess obviously he does.
Sure. Why not?
I mean, who knows what my best explanation. Who knows what a precocious droid could get up to over the course of a millennia, right?
Yeah. It's all, anyway, all the Jedi programming.
It was a little off-putting, or I guess strained credulity, that Hu Yang is so good at everything. You want to talk about a Mary Sue? So far, Hu Yang appears to be a Mary Sudo. That's a Macintosh programming joke for you.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But also, it's a Japanese joke, isn't it? And he does the Boken training stuff. Mm-hmm. Wow, that works on too. I'm actually really proud of that. Mary Sudo. It's when a droid is really good at everything. There we go. Anyway, so yeah, I'm a little upset that Hu Yang is an expert lightsaber crafter. He has encyclopedic knowledge of everybody's lightsaber style and hilt and whatnot. And he's good at repairing the starship, and he can help heal people because he knows first aid stuff, and he is all about logistics. And he's an amazingly good pilot who's able to dogfight in a Jedi cruiser or Jedi light cruiser. I don't think of the T-6 as a Jedi fighter. At the very least, I would think of it as a Jedi scout ship. It's just little too big to be a fighter.
It's a fighter in the sense that if you classify all starships as either capital starships or fighters, it's certainly not a capital starship. But yeah, it's more of a almost a light freighter.
Yeah, it's kind of like her version of the Millennium Falcon. Even the cockpit feels Falcon-esque or YT-1300-like. So yeah. I can't say much, though, because, you know, we styled our ship after the Falcon. So what are you going to do? You're going to complain about Hu Yang being a Mary Sue Doe. That's right.
That is exactly what we're going to do.
Complete the joke. All right. Moving on to the question that might take a long time to dissect here. What connections did you draw to the larger Star Wars galaxy? I'm going to go first because I have one big main one, and I know you've got lots of them. mine was, of course, Dr. Hu Yang. In addition to all the other stuff he's really good at, he's really good at quoting Star Wars lore and history, because when he was talking about being amongst the minefield and the asteroids and the whalebone chunks, he said, if we stay out here much longer, we're going to be pulverized, which was a direct homage to the asteroid field scene in Episode 5, The Empire Strikes Back, which was great. Unlike some people in Star Wars fandom online who have been complaining about the meta moments taking them out of the story, that just felt awesome to me because, in addition to an obvious homage and quote from Episode 5, it was a logical thing for a droid to say at that moment in time. And so I liked that it worked on both levels. And it was correct, too. They were going to get pulverized. Mm-hmm. And then they continued their Empire Strikes Back homage by going and hiding out inside an asteroid. Or a chunk of whalebone, which is basically an asteroid here. I was almost expecting a animal to try to eat them or whatnot, but they've already sort of done the go in the thing's mouth with the
That period. Was on my list.
Yeah. That okay, was... sorry. I'm cannibalizing your whalebone list. go for it. What else you got as connections?
Yeah, so I was going to bring up the fact that we have a lot of connections to Episode 5. Not just that quote, but also just hiding in the whalebones felt very much like hiding in the asteroids, complete with we are going out of the mouth of some space entity. Now, that was done a little bit differently. They were in there on purpose instead of on accident, but still we got a similar shot of, you know, mouth opening ship coming out. So that was a very nice connection.
Mouth opening and stars become visible.
Yes. Yeah. Thrawn did his usual, you think that we've lost, but here's how we've actually won. Very in keeping with his character. We saw some LAAT ships. Mm-hmm. Now, we did actually see those in an earlier episode, just hanging out in the hangar. But this time we saw them actually in use, dropping the night troopers off. These were used in Rebels. We also saw them in the Clone Wars. We saw a similar version, or not a similar version, a different version of a similar ship in Attack of the Clones when the clones show up on Geonosis. A little bit different design, though. Ezra's friends reminded me of Ewoks because they threw stuff, random stuff, at the bad guys. One of them threw a frying pan, which I love.
that was almost a nod to Samwise Gamgee in Lord of the Rings.
One of them used a slingshot, which I have to assume that Ezra taught them how to build and use slingshots. Or if not directly taught them, at least one of them watched Ezra using a slingshot at one point and was like, "Ooh, I bet I can do that too." So that was really cool. And everything else on my list was episode 5 callbacks. So I will finish off with saying, let's watch out for a Return of the Jedi quote in the next show. Because we have had a New Hope quote, and we've had an Empire Strikes Back quote so far. Mm-hmm. I would not be surprised if we get some sort of always thinking with your stomach or fly casual, something like that in the next episode.
We almost had a Return of the Jedi reference with Ezra in this episode, because when he and Sabine are about to fight Shin Hati and they think it's 2-on-1, it's no big deal. But then the night troopers show up and disembark and they're coming after him. And Ezra's like, wait, don't you want to capture us? Yeah, you could take us captive and take us to. Yeah, he's all like, isn't that how we usually do these things? Yeah, and then Shin
Hati. Well, this is a kid's show. You can't kill us. Wait, yeah. We're not a cartoon still? Oh.
We're not a cartoon anymore?
Yeah.
All right. Question number 4. This was my custom question for this episode. And we probably won't really have a good answer, at least not until next episode. But the question is, where did Baylan Skoll go? Even Grand Admiral Thrawn was kind of all like, these were acceptable losses given the absence of Lord Baylan. And he kind of looked at Morgan Elsbeth like, yo, where's your guy? You were acting like he's a ringer and now he's MIA. So yeah, he had a pretty cool lightsaber duel with Ahsoka, where they were both obviously, once again, not really trying to kill each other, but just trying to stop each other. And then he kind of was like, well, I've delayed you from saving the day long enough, Ahsoka. I've got to go do the thing that I planned to do when I came here to Peridia. So, Nathan, what's the deal? Where did he go? What's happening? Any insights?
Well, I've said this before, but I still think it's true. I still think that he's looking for an entrance to the world between worlds, which I still think is, if not the same thing as Mortis, at least connected to Mortis. I think Mortis is kind of a manifestation of the world between worlds. And I think that he's going back to Rebels. In Rebels, the Imperial archaeologist dude was whoever controls the world between worlds controls the fate of the galaxy. And I think Baylan recognizes that fact, or believes it at least. I don't know that it's true, but I think he thinks it's true. And he's looking for an entrance to that world. And it kind of makes sense that it would be related to the Dathomir witches. Could be a way that they got to our galaxy in the first place. Now I know the common thinking is, they took the Purrgil. It may be that they had more than one way.
Yeah. Or maybe they had encountered our galaxy via the World Between Worlds. But as we know from Dave Filoni's commentary from the season 4 DVD release of Star Wars Rebels, you can't leave the world between worlds through a gateway that is different from the one that you use to enter it. So this common idea out there online amongst fandom of, well, you can go back in time and fix things with the world between worlds, or you can go forward in time and fix the sequels. They can finally retcon, blah, blah. No, the sequels are canon. Accept it or move on, you guys. So that part, I think, is not quite what the Night Sisters might have been able to do with the world between worlds in the time before time. I think that, as much as I love all the prepositional phrasing here, world between worlds, time before time, I think that what they did was they encountered the knowledge of it, because Dave said in that commentary, it's about knowledge. It's not about time travel. And then they devised the way of riding the Purrgil as a way to accomplish moving from one galaxy to another.
That makes sense.
And so, you know, they knew about the Prime Galaxy, if you will, because of the knowledge they gained in the world between worlds, but they couldn't actually go there through those doorways. Now, this isn't to say that some of them might not have tried, but I think, and we might see that that is the way that Lord Baylan meets his end, is that he'll find an entrance, and then he'll be like, ah, I can go back to Order 66 or whatever, and, you know, fix it. And he'll try to step through and change that timeline, and something horrible will happen. He'll, like, evaporate or disappear, or he'll fall like Ahsoka did when she was in the world between worlds, because there's nothing for him to stand on the other side of that gateway, and he'll end up back in his own subconscious again, and then he'll just be trapped on Peridia, you know, until he dies, or whatever. Or, alternatively, here's my answer to the question. He is seeking a powerful force entity a la the Bindu that we saw in Star Wars Rebels, or the father or the son from Mortis. But the force entity that Baylan is seeking is not the daughter, the father, or the son. It's the mother. And so we've never seen or heard an indication amongst the Mortis mythos of a mother, but except, of course, for the implication that she would exist based on the other three characters, because in order to have a father, a son, and a daughter, you need a mother. And this planet, Peridia, is ruled by whom? That's right, the Dark Mothers. So if there is a mother for Mortis, surely that mother would be manifested somehow on this planet of Dark Mothers, Peridia.
I like that. So, and it could be that the Night Sisters have molded themselves after the mother, and that's why they have all the red cloth and why they do a lot of the things that they do.
And the face paint and whatnot. Yeah.
I like
this theory. So I think it, and there is a entity in Star Wars lore, current canon as well. I can't think of the creature's name, but she's basically a force woman that is like using dark side powers. While you set us up for the next question, I'm going to Google that real quick, because it starts with an A and I can't think of it. And some listener is probably throwing popcorn at their podcast right now saying, Scott, you moron, it's obviously blah, blah, blah. Anyway, go on.
It's obviously Ahsoka, the clone of Ahsoka. No, we make that joke way too often with adding vowels. All right. So the final question for today, and this is my custom question, and much like the previous question, I don't know that we'll have a good answer for it. It's more of a topic of conversation. But what has Ezra been up to? He's apparently been stuck on Peridia for about 10 years now, and he seems to be a lot more powerful in the Force. He's obviously befriended the Turtle people. But what else has he done? That's a lot of time. So, Scott, have you found it?
I have. The entity's name is Abeloth. A-B-E-L-O-T-H. And she's not canon. My bad that she has actually been decanonized. But here is a quote referencing her from one Mara Jade Skywalker. So there's another Heir to the Empire connection. She is ancient and powerful and dangerous. Very dangerous. But you're on to her now. She is never what she appears to be. Remember that. And Mara is talking about the Abeloth here. And it is from, let's find a source of the original Legends canon here. In any event, she was a powerful dark side force entity. And she once did serve the Mortis characters. as one of their envoys or whatnot.
Okay, so this could be a really long article. This could be another case of pulling something from Legends and making it canon again. After all, that's what happened with Thrawn. He was decanonized and recanonized.
Yeah, she was a dark side entity in the Fate of the Jedi series of books from back in the day. And first appeared in Fate of the Jedi Outcast, written by Aaron Alston. I think I need to say, may he rest in peace here. I believe Aaron has... Yes, Aaron died in 2014. Yes, I was right. Aaron had passed away. So, yes, Aaron Alston wrote this book, Fate of the Jedi Outcast, which was first published by Del Rey in hardcover in March of 2009. And so it is about Luke Skywalker and the new Jedi Order doing some stuff.
All right. Well, that brings us to my question that I had just been explaining. What do you think Ezra's been up to in these past 10 years?
So I think that you did a great job setting this up about, you know, what is the deal? And I think that we're given a hint as to his current status, both in the fact that Thrawn didn't seem too concerned about where Ezra was, nor did he seem too concerned about just telling Sabine, we think he's over there. Here's a horse. You know, here's a rodent of unusual size. Knock yourself out. Like, it's almost as though he and Ezra had sort of reached detente once they got there. I don't think that's what happened. I think they fought for a while, and Ezra was doing the guerrilla rebel thing, and he was trying to make sure that Grand Admiral Thrawn was always kept, you know, on his toes and on the back foot so that he couldn't spend his incredible intellect toward finding a way back home all by himself. Although apparently he still ended up getting the job done via the Night Sisters and their communications with Morgan Elspeth in the Prime Galaxy. I think when Ezra was refusing to take his lightsaber and sort of implying that he's not really about that life anymore, we're to get that he sort of did what Obi-Wan did and what Luke Skywalker does in the sequel trilogy, and realizing that continually fighting the Empire, continually fighting the dark side, is not always the right answer. Wars not make one great. Thank you, Master Yoda. I think Ezra had sort of come to a place of peace, and he had ascended to the point where he didn't need weapons because he had become a weapon, and then realized, of course, like many great martial arts masters, when they spend time and time and time training and training and training, they realize that the way doesn't always involve violence and fighting my enemies in literal hand-to-hand combat, in literal warfare. I can oppose my enemies by other means, by non-violent means. I can live my best life as the way to make sure that they fail in stopping me and my friends from achieving what we want to achieve. And I think that's where Ezra's gone. He's much like Master Luke and Obi-Wan before him, and Yoda between them. He took himself out of the equation because he realized that he had a higher purpose, and he sort of ascended to a higher plane, which isn't great for a space action franchise, but is really good for a literary space fantasy franchise. And I believe that once again, we will bump up against that, where certain fans are going to hate this idea that Ezra just kind of quote-unquote didn't do anything to stop the Empire, or in this case, Thrawn, as the representative of the Empire, while the two of them were trapped on Peridia, never realizing that that's exactly what he did need to do, was keep Thrawn out of the battle between the Rebellion and the Empire. Because if Grand Admiral Thrawn had been there, the Empire probably would have survived. Thrawn would never have accepted the whole thing about, let's take Luke prisoner and bring him right up to the Emperor, you know? He would have seen right through that. Then again, also, if Thrawn had been there, based on the Thrawn characterization in the most recent Timothy Zahn Thrawn novels, the ones from this century, he might not have let the Empire get to the point that it was. Because while he isn't exactly a hero, he's always fought for order and honor.
He and General Tage would have gotten along really well. In the comics, Tage survived the Death Star by going back to the fleet before it got to Yavin, and between A New Hope and Empire Strikes Back, he did a whole lot of, you know, efficient things. He's like, we don't need to build a whole nother Death Star. We need to build more Star Destroyers, because we can have, you know, if we build 100 Star Destroyers for the same price that we could build the Death Star, we can have them at 100 different systems, and a Star Destroyer is generally enough. And Thrawn had kind of a similar idea. You know, he had the TIE Defender program, and that kind of got scrapped or delayed in favor of making the Death Star. He would have opposed the Death Star too.
I just thought about something. What if the stuff that's in those crates are the pieces to make TIE Defenders?
Ooh, yeah. We've been kind of running on the assumption that they're corpses and that they're going to be animated with dark magic, but it would be much more in keeping with Thrawn from Rebels if they were just TIE Defender parts. Yeah.
And if the big finale battle for Ahsoka, the streaming series, is the live action debut of a TIE Defender squadron, and we get a nice, awesome, oh, that's what's going to happen. That's exactly what's in those things, because the Ghost and, the Ghost and Phoenix Squadron. No, what's Carson Teva's squadron called?
Adelphi Rangers. Yeah, Phoenix Squadron was the Rebels in Rebels. Yes,
thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. So the Ghost.
So I know where Hera, you got it from.
With Hera piloting it, and those Rangers are in their X-Wings, are going to have to fight like a squadron of TIE Defenders. And they're going to like just freak out, because only one or two of them have ever seen one in real life. And the fans are going to go nuts, because that's going to be the awesome, cool special effect unveiling of live action TIE Defenders. Look at, and then people who don't know what they are going to lose their minds at three triple winged TIE fighters. And they're going to be like, wow. And the rebellion is going to, the New Republic is going to show up with their fleet, and they're going to be like, oh, TIE fighters, no problem. And they're going to shoot at them, and they're going to have deflector shields on, and they're all going to be like, oh my gosh, what are we going to do? And the Republic fleet will lose that fight. And then at the end of the cliffhanger at part eight ending will be Thrawn being all, yes, everything is proceeding as I foresee.
We were talking on Culture Clash about how Thrawn doesn't quite seem as competent as he should, and how it's in part because he's fighting against the heroes who have a sort of plot armor. He can't really kill Ezra and Sabine and Ahsoka, or we don't have a story anymore. He needs to be able to go up against something that he can actually defeat and have the story continue. And I suggested, and still think, and this could fold right in with what you were just saying, I think he's going to destroy Home One.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Because we've had made a big deal out of, oh, look, it's Home One, the heroic capital ship from the second Death Star battle in Return of the Jedi.
That we see in the sequel trilogy.
Yeah, a shining beacon of rebellious hope and whatnot. And if a bunch of TIE Defenders and the Chimera blow it out of the sky, that would really be a dagger to the heart for morale in the New Republic fleet.
If Hera and Jason are on the Ghost when that happens, they survive that. So we can still have them in the story, even though they're in the fight, and you know, they get to escape and be the ones to tell everybody, hey, by the way, the fleet's gone.
Yeah. Oops. And I think, unfortunately, this may be the battle where we lose Carson. I think Carson Teva might die in this fight.
I'm thinking not, because I think he's still the guy who's showing up in all the shows. I think he's going to continue to be that guy. I don't think we're going to lose him. Yes. I don't think we're going to lose him until we get to Avengers, which is going to be the Dave Filoni movie.
Okay. I could see that. But I think we do have to have somebody that we know get killed during this fight. With the first time Thrawn shows up, he's got to really make an impact. Destroying Home One will be big. Oh, gosh, no. I bet I know who it is. I'll predict now in the fight, Zeb bites it.
Oh. Ooh.
Yeah. I don't want him to die, but that's what I'm saying. If I were writing
that, that would hurt, but save so much on the budget.
Yeah. Yes, he costs too much to animate in live action, and we can't build a purple foam suit. Come on, people. Anyway, so there's my prediction. We'll have a big space fight, TIE Defenders live action debut. People will lose their minds. Excellent dogfight, amazing starship battle as the big finale on Ahsoka. So much so that we might actually see Ahsoka do her jump out of the ship and fight with lightsabers in space thing again. But I'm wondering, I'm thinking that you're right about the World Between Worlds being some way for them to get back to the Galaxy Prime. And I think that they'll be able to figure out a way to do it that the Night Sisters of Antiquity could not figure out. Mm-hmm. I can't quite wrap my head around it yet, but that's okay.
I'm wondering if, and I know you can't affect time with it, but I'm wondering if you might be able to go out in a different physical location, and that'd be fine as long as you aren't jumping in time.
Alternatively, maybe Ahsoka and Sabine and Ezra put their heads together and find a way to make it to where, yeah, we're going to leave through the same gateway that we came in, but we're going to move the location of that gateway in real space while we're inside the World Between Worlds.
Yeah, I could see that. And maybe show up on Lothal at the temple where the other gateway to the World Between Worlds is. I could see the Lothwolves come. Oh, it's Dave Filoni. We cannot pass up this opportunity to have Lothwolves show up in live action and escort them from Peridia to Lothal through the World Between Worlds.
Yeah. Interesting.
And
anyway, my
have one of them be Doom.
Oh yeah, that'd be cool. That'd be so super
that
cool.
That way we can honor Kanan Jarrus without actually having Kanan Jarrus show up, because he did.
So my broader point was going to be, if we're doing a Star Wars finale, and we are, you're going to have your triple arena of fights.
You need the space, planet,
ground, and some kind of personal force thing.
Yeah.
And so the War Between Worlds could be some kind of force thing. Wouldn't it be cool if they find that that's what Baylan was doing, and they realize they got to stop him. And so Ahsoka and Baylan fight inside the World Between Worlds as our lightsaber piece of our finale. I don't know what would be our ground piece, but we definitely
have our space piece. That could be Sabine and Ezra and Lothwolves.
They got to keep the doorway open while Ahsoka goes in to stop Baylan. Yeah, they got to keep the doorway open from the night troopers that are trying to blow up the thing so that Thrawn and them could leave. Yeah. They should hire us to write this. Anyway, but yeah, there we go. Now, all of that could be completely wrong, and that's okay. I'll still enjoy the finale, but that'll be a fun finale. And it certainly would fit with our Star Wars formula, and man, does Dave love making sure he follows George Lucas's formula. And as well he should, because it's a billion-dollar franchise for a reason. Mm-hmm. Okay, so yeah, that's, I believe, what all has Ezra been up to at this time, is becoming, you know, more enlightened Jedi master.
Recognizing that just because the Jedi die doesn't mean the light dies. I think this is a big thing. We have all these Boken Jedi. We've got Ezra. We've got Jason. We've got Grogu. I think they aren't all going to go to the Jedi Temple. I think they're going to not be there when Kylo Ren destroys it, because they've all realized we don't have to be Jedi. We don't have to follow Luke Skywalker. And Luke realizes too late that, you know, they're kind of right. They don't have to be Jedi. They're still the light. And it's okay for me to kind of withdraw from the galaxy, because the light's still out there.
Yeah.
You know, Ezra and Grogu and Jason may still all be out there. Just not Jedi.
Yeah, exactly. The fandom and the writers, to a certain extent, have been dropping all these hints and fans picking up on them about gray Jedi over the past decade. And Dave Filoni has said there's no such thing as a gray Jedi. But what he means isn't there's no such thing as a Force user who walks the middle way. What he means is that person wouldn't call themselves a Jedi in any format, gray, light, dark, anything. If light Jedi and dark Jedi are the ones that are at the polar ends of the Force spectrum, if you're the Bindu, if you're walking the middle path, you're going to call yourself something else.
Mm-hmm. Well, and or you call yourself nothing. That's what Baylan Skoll's doing. He tells people, I'm not a Jedi. He doesn't tell people that he's a Sith either, though, because he's not. He's something else.
And Ahsoka is the poster child of I'm no Jedi, but that doesn't mean that she's not a hero.
Right. The light has not died. She's just not a Jedi. So I think Ezra has discovered that in the past 10 years, that he doesn't have to be a Jedi to use the Force and be part of the light. And I agree with you that he has learned that he doesn't need to directly go fight Grand Admiral Thrawn. He can resist him in other ways. It reminds me, if I may go back to one of Dave Filoni's other works, of Avatar The Last Airbender.
You don't say.
I do say. And there's a character named Bumi. He's really, really old, 112 years old, so old that he remembers Aang from before he was frozen for 100 years. And he's the king of a particular city. That city gets captured. He gets captured. The bad guys, the Fire Nation, have him imprisoned. They've covered up everything but his face so that he can't use his earthbending to escape. The people of the city have fled, and they've started this resistance, and they all think the king has forsaken them. And Aang comes in and tries to rescue him, but Bumi actually refuses and reveals that he could do bending this whole time. They didn't cover up his face, and he's so powerful that he's bending with his chin. He's like, "Ugh." And he talks to Aang about Jing. And he says, do you know what this is? He's like, "Oh, yeah, it's like energy. You have positive Jing when you're attacking and negative Jing when you are retreating." And Bumi says, "Well, there's actually another type of Jing." And Aang says, "There's three?" He says, "Well, actually, there's like 87. But for our purposes, I want to talk about one other one. It's neutral Jing. When you do nothing. When you wait for the right time to do something, because now's not the right time." I think that's what Ezra's realized, is the meantime was not the right time. When Sabine shows up, okay, now's the right time to do something. But in the meantime, patience is the key. So I think he's been doing a lot of meditating. I think he's been practicing with the Force. I don't think he's been building a lightsaber, because I don't think he's got access to kyber crystals. And I think that's part of the reason why he refused a lightsaber at the end. He's like, "I don't need that. I've had 10 years practice of not having a lightsaber."
Although I will point out that when he began to be overwhelmed with too many night troopers, he did grab somebody's blaster that he did do that.
Yeah.
Use it. Yeah.
So, but it was the right time to do it.
Yeah. That was more of the pragmatic nature,
Yes. So I think we're kind of on the same wavelength of what Ezra's been doing. And it seems like a whole lot of nothing from the outside looking in, but it's not.
Yeah, yeah. It's very deep and philosophical movements in the Force. So that'll be great. I also think that we will get to see that story of what he did with Thrawn when they first got to Peridia 10 years ago. But I think we'll see it in a comic or maybe video game.
Comics seem like a great place to put that.
Yeah, yeah. All right, cool. Well, whatever happens in Ahsoka's finale, whether it's my TIE Defender theory or something completely different, you can guarantee that we're going to discuss it ad nauseum here on What a Piece of Junk. But first, we're going to take a break and come back and talk a little bit about the best pilots in Star Wars, ranked by our friends at GameRant.com. However, for now, let's sit back and let Kevin tell us all about all the other shows that you can listen to here on the Fandom Podcast Network.
Thank you for listening. We hope you're enjoying this podcast. Here are the other great shows on the Fandom Podcast Network. Culture Clash, where we discuss the latest in entertainment and pop culture. Blood of Kings, our show covering the entire Highlander universe. Couch Potato Theater, we celebrate our favorite movies. And Time Warp, our fandom flashback show discussing a year in movies and our favorite retro movie, TV, and pop culture topics. Good Evening, discussing all things Alfred Hitchcock. Hair Metal Podcast, we cover the rock metal music of the 80s and early 90s. Type 40, a Doctor Who podcast, discussing the time-traveling Doctor Who universe. Lethal Mullet, an action film podcast, covering the 80s, 90s, and beyond. Also, check out the Lethal Mullet Network for more great podcasts. What a Piece of Junk, our Star Wars podcast. Making Treks, a Star Trek podcast, with a deep dive into the final frontier. The Fandom Show, our Fandom Podcast Network live YouTube show discussing the hottest topics in fandom. The True Believers MCU Podcast, discussing the Marvel Cinematic and Television Universe. Union Federation, our Star Trek and the Orville show. And we're proud to welcome the BQN Network to the Fandom Podcast Network. Please visit our friends on the BQN Network, a Star Trek Universe podcast that also includes your favorite topics, movies, history, superheroes, and more. You can find the Fandom Podcast Network on YouTube. The Fandom Podcast Network is also on all major podcast platforms. The Fandom Podcast Network audio master feed is on Podbean at fpnet.podbean.com. You can find the Fandom Podcast Network on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You can email us at fandompodcastnetwork@gmail.com. Thank you so much for listening, and remember, respect others and enjoy your fandom.
All right, thank you very much, Kevin, for that update. So, Nathan, we've got another listicle, and maybe we won't hate on this listicle as much as we have some of our listicles. But it is from our friends at GameRant.com, written by one Christy Ambrose, published back at the end of September. And it is titled Star Wars, The 8 Best Pilots Ranked. I'm not really sure
eight.
Why we have
not
8
10.
Instead of 10, or maybe just 5, but we have 8. So there you go. So the subhead is pretty good. Becoming a capable pilot in Star Wars usually takes work, but the skill seems to come naturally to these particular characters. So again, not necessarily trying to harp on ye old Mary Sue if so-and-so is always good at piloting amongst everything else, but rather, for these particular characters, piloting seems to be a natural or inborn talent. So when the setting is outer space and the creator of the story is inspired by the dogfights of World War II, the plot is
That's
going
very
to
correct.
Include some famous pilots. The lore of Star Wars includes all kinds of heroes and villains, and the roster of famous names includes some of the best starfighters in the galaxy. So here we go, coming in at number 8. So
I want to be clear. I have not read this list yet.
Yes,
so
that's right.
I'm making predictions in my mind, and we'll see how close I am.
Oh, well, I'll actually let you make predictions before I do each number. So we're going to go lowest to highest. So we're 8 counting down to 1, with 1 being the best.
All right.
So 8, who do you think is number 8 on her list? And I will let you know, having looked at the list ahead of time, it is all across Star Wars. You don't have to limit Ooh. Yourself to movies, streaming, comics, whatever, just anything.
Anything.
Although all of these characters are currently canon, so you
okay.
don't have to worry about legends.
So I've got a cool way to show you who I think is number 8. I was okay. cleaning out a box the other day to put Marvel Crisis Protocol stuff in, and realized I have some old X-Wing models.
Oh,
so I'm
nice.
Going with Hera Syndulla as my number 8.
Okay, so I will tell you that Hera is not number 8, but I will tell you that Hera is on this list. So you
okay,
know
good.
She is 7 or above. Number 8, according to this writer, is Han Solo himself.
Oh!
He is number 8.
Okay, I was going to put Han Solo a little bit higher than that.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
But he was in my thinking as well.
Yep, so here is her rationale, and then we can talk about whether or not we agree with her. Perhaps one of the most famous names in the Star Wars franchise is also one of its most skilled and notorious pilots, and his ship, the Millennium Falcon, is just as well known. Watching Han at the helm of different ships in Solo gave fans some background when it came to Han's history of piloting skills. The life of a smuggler is as much about fancy flying as it is about stealth and trickery, and Han Solo is the type of pilot who has to think beyond the concept of light speed. It's a combination of speed, deception, and guerrilla warfare that makes Han such a great pilot. I'm going to agree with her based on the other names on this list. So I have a little bit of a foreknowledge that you do here, but I think she's right that Han's piloting skill isn't always about being super technically proficient, and it's not always about being just the fastest guy. Now, it's the fastest hunk of junk in the galaxy, but it can go really fast even when Han's not piloting the Falcon, as we see with Lando. And in some cases, just Chewbacca himself makes the Falcon mm-hmm. kick butt. And of course, Finn isn't too bad at firing the gun. And Rey is really good at piloting the Falcon. The ship is a tool. And if you know what you're doing, you can really utilize the Falcon to do some amazing stuff as a pilot. But Han is more about deception and that guerrilla warfare, like she says here. Sometimes Han's best maneuvers is when he fakes out the other pilot and they bite on one of his jukes and then he's able to escape. And often Chewie is saving the day in the cockpit. We saw this in Solo itself when they're skidding across the ice on one of those asteroids making the Kessel Run, and he turns the controls over to Chewie and he's all like, I'm gonna hit the bilats and then boom, it's all you. Go, go, go. And well, Chewbacca is doing his thing.
Quite frankly, in A New Hope, when they return to the Death Star, Han is in the gun turret, which means Chewie's the one flying. So, yeah, Han's a great pilot, but he often isn't actually piloting. He does relatively little piloting for how good of a pilot he is.
Yeah, yeah, totally. All right, so, yeah, we pretty much agree with Miss Ambrose here that Han Solo is a good number 8. All right, Nathan, what's your prediction about number 7? I'll have to give you a hint on this one. It's a character that you probably know better than me or Derek.
Oh, okay. Well, I was going to say Dash Rendar, but you did say that they were all currently legend. Canon.
Yeah.
And he is legend, so I'm going to have to throw that one out. Somebody that I know better.
Throw that out
better. Well, I had already guessed Hera, who probably qualifies, but the other... Plo Koon. I bet it's Plo Koon.
You're super close. It is a Jedi from the Clone Wars era, and a Jedi member of the... member of the High Council. It is Adi Gallia.
Plo Koon is a...
I would agree with you.
Go ahead and give me the reasons why, but then I'll tell them why they're wrong.
Before the Clone Wars broke out, Adi Gallia held a prestigious role as one of the most astute political strategists in the Jedi Order. She came from Coruscant and grew up in an upper-class family with ties to local leadership along with important business connections, which served her well during her time as part of the High Council. After the Clone Wars started, she was promoted to the rank of Jedi General in the Grand Army of the Republic, and much of her time was spent in the air. Her role in the Battle of Lola Sayu included flying as one of the general, as one of General Saiz Tin's wing commanders. So this is about her piloting Jedi starfighters during the Clone Wars. I'm kind of with you. I think that Plo Koon would have made more sense at number 7 for very similar reasons.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Plo Koon is the one that we see get shot down in Order 66. He's literally flying a mission when Order 66 happens, which is why his clone trooper, his clone commander, Wolf, is not with him. So that's why he can show up later in Rebels, because he was on the ground. Plo Koon was in the air. Plo Koon can also breathe in space, or at least survive in space for a little while without needing to breathe, because he's got the respirator. We see that in the Clone Wars. He actually is in an escape pod with a few clones and goes outside and stands on the escape pod. Suit or anything, because he's got the stuff to survive. Not for long, but for a little while.
I almost feel like that Adi Gallia may have been included here to get another female character on this list. I don't want to use the term diversity and inclusion, but I would have, but if even if that is the case, I would have put Rey Skywalker at number 7. Rey's a very capable pilot in this.
Oh, I just assumed she was a little higher on the list.
Bless you.
Excuse
me. Maybe, but probably not. All right.
Okay. Well, let me throw that one out.
Number 6. All right. Who do you think is number 6? And my only hint here is going to be that I was not expecting to see this character this low on the list.
Oh. In that case, I'm going to guess Wedge Antilles.
You're super close. It is one of Wedge's Rogue Squadron compatriots. But it is Luke Skywalker himself. Christie has Luke as number 6. So here's her rationale. When Luke first appears in the Star Wars franchise, his goal is to attend the Flight Academy along with his friends. Mm-hmm. He's always been eager to escape the slow, dull life of farming on Tatooine. And then, of course, gets more than he bargained for with a crash course in fighter pilot training when he gets mixed up with the Rebel Alliance. Luke Skywalker is one of the best pilots in the lore of Star Wars, and most would say that he inherited his skills from his father. Like Anakin, Luke already had a reputation for his skills with speeders and small tactical ships, like a T-16 Skyhopper, before he piloted X-Wings in space. And yeah, Luke does some amazing piloting stuff in Star Wars A New Hope. If we're looking at just on-screen performances, that's about the most starfighter-y stuff that Luke does. The rest of the time that we see him in the original trilogy, or even in Expanded Universe stuff that's live action, piloting his X-Wing, it's almost using it like a taxi or a Cadillac to get from one place to another. In The Empire Strikes Back, he flies his X-Wing from Hoth to Dagobah.
Where he crashes.
Where he crashes, yes. And then from
although I still suspect that was Yoda guiding him down.
Probably, yeah. And then he flies from Dagobah to Bespin. And I've never been real clear how Red 5 gets retrieved from Cloud City, because he certainly doesn't fly away in it.
I was thinking about this the other day. I think he gets a new X-Wing, and he just keeps the call sign, which would mean that the Red 5 that Rey retrieves is not the Red 5 that blew up the Death Star.
No, it's not, because that would be still on Bespin, or more than likely destroyed by the Empire once they take over Cloud City.
Or taken as a trophy. Now, it could be that it is the same Red 5 if they recovered it from the Empire, but that would still mean that he has a different Red 5 when he goes back to Dagobah in Return of the Jedi.
Yeah, because I'm trying to remember. I don't believe we see in Return of the Jedi, we don't see Luke getting into his X-Wing and heading to Dagobah. We just see them leaving Tatooine.
Well, he's in an X-Wing when they leave Tatooine.
Right, but and I mean, we don't see it docked somewhere where he gets into it and then they take it off.
We just see it in flight, and then we see it landed on Dagobah.
Yeah, I believe it's hinted at that it and the Falcon were parked in the same spot out in the desert in the deleted scenes that were revealed decades later, where we see Luke building his green lightsaber in a cave with R2-D2 in Return of the Jedi. And I believe also after they rescue Han, we see them walking through a sandstorm to get on board the Falcon and he on board his X-Wing. But I think you're right. It would have had to have been a new X-Wing, because unless Lando pulled a really big, important favor from somebody who was still hanging out on Cloud City to meet them somewhere with Luke's X-Wing.
What was Lobot doing?
Yeah. Well, actually, we have an answer about Lobot in recent Star Wars comics from Marvel.
Do tell.
Not to give too much away, but there's a storyline where Lobot was hacked in his implant, and the Empire is using Lobot to blackmail Lando. Because they're like, do what we say, or we're going to blow up blow up Lobot's head or whatever. I'm oversimplifying the storyline, but yeah, it's very much a.
Well, they did something similar in an episode of Rebels, so I wouldn't put it past the Empire to do it.
Yeah, totally. All right.
So,
but anyway, there you have it. Luke at number 6.
I agree with putting Luke fairly low on this list because we are talking about piloting specifically, and while it is a great accomplishment to blow up the Death Star, that has more to do with him using the Force than his actual piloting skills. And we don't really see him piloting much other than that. He does pilot Rogue One in Empire Strikes Back, which is a snowspeeder, which gets shot down. His gunner dies. He gets out and takes down an AT-AT with a lightsaber, which is not piloting. Impressive feat, not piloting. So I'm okay with putting him that low on the list. I think blowing up the Death Star gives him a spot on the list, but 6 sounds good to me.
Yep. All right. What's your prediction for pilot number 5? Do you want a hint?
Sure, I'll take a hint.
He is known for being able to fly just about anything.
Known for being able to fly just about anything. Okay, well, I'm going to take Wedge off the board because he pilots an X-Wing and pretty much just that. I was kind of expecting Lando to show up somewhere on this, but he doesn't pilot all that many different things. He's usually piloting the Falcon.
We definitely get to see this character pilot a variety of craft. So he's not just bragging when he says I can fly just about anything.
In that case, I'm going to guess, although if I'm right about this, then he's not in the spot I was expecting. I'm going to guess Anakin Skywalker / Darth Vader. Because he does pilot a lot of different things.
He does, and that's a good guess, but this character is Poe Dameron from the sequel trilogy. So, number five, we have Poe Dameron. So
I'm going to retain my, he's not in the spot I thought he was. I was expecting Poe Dameron to be number two, with Anakin being number one. Poe Dameron, incredible pilot. The first movie we see him in, he shoots down 10 TIE fighters in a row in the span of about a minute or less, honestly, just a few seconds, really. Most pilots don't shoot down 10 enemy fighters in their lifetimes, and he shoots 10 just casually, like it's nothing. To me, he's on like super heroic levels of pilots.
He is S-tier level
pilot. Absolutely S-tier. So I'm surprised that he's all the way down at five. But give me their reasoning.
Poe Dameron's piloting skills are reminiscent of Han Solo's in the sense that he got them from smuggling and survival as opposed to formal training. His first ship was a distinct X-Wing fighter with a dark color scheme called Black One, as appeared in The Force Awakens. Poe has many notable accomplishments as a pilot, and a few of the most famous occurred during the Battle of Starkiller Base, in which he led the charge to destroy the planet. He's famous for knowing how to fly just about anything. And that's true, because at the very first time we see him piloting something, he attempts to pilot his X-Wing, which isn't Black One, by the way, when he's trying to leave from the settlement on
Jakku.
The settlement on Jakku.
Where Lorsen Tekka was.
With Lorsen Tekka. He tries to leave, but he can't, and so he jumps out and tries to save Lorsen Tekka and friends. Is unable to do that, gets captured, and then, of course, freed by Finn, where he flies them out of there, leaving the Finalizer on a First Order TIE fighter. So a craft that he had never flown before, and he not only helps them escape with it, but he outflies a lot of the fire and the starfighters that are sent after them by the First Order. So, yeah, he's able to fly just about anything, and he's almost always good at it.
All right, yeah, he definitely is good at it. He definitely flies a lot of different things. I didn't even hit on Starkiller Base, which is, frankly, a much greater feat of piloting than what Luke did at the Death Star. Again, not downplaying the Death Star at all here, but that was more about using the Force than the actual piloting.
Yeah.
Having to dodge lasers and whatnot on Starkiller Base and go around and destroy quite a few different nodes felt very video gamey, quite frankly.
It did,
But you know, it was to the point where I could see him being the main character in a video game where you're doing all of this stuff and like there's other ships around, but let's be honest, you're the one doing everything. That's what it felt like when Poe was piloting. So I would have bumped him up to just insane levels of like number two, only because there's somebody else who's even better at number one in my mind.
All right. What's your guess for number four? The hint here is it is a character you've already mentioned and you were expecting to be on this list.
All right. Well, in that case, I'm going to go with Hera again.
No.
So it's close. Wedge.
It is Wedge. Yes. You get half a point for getting it on your very second guess. Wedge Antilles, one of the few pilots who served with Luke Skywalker and survived as long as he did. Wedge Antilles was one of the two lone survivors of Red Squadron. So, of course, from the Battle of Yavin. He made a few quick appearances in the original Star Wars film as part of the Rebel Alliance and a member of the attack force on the original Death Star. He would appear again as the leader of Rogue Squadron in the Battle of Hoth, and he fought again in the Battle of Endor in the skies above the Forest Moon. Few other pilots in the Star Wars universe were as skilled and lucky as Wedge. And for Wedge, for me, it is all about skill, is that he had learned so well at the Academy, and now that we've moved beyond the 1980s in Star Wars canon, we saw a young Wedge in Star Wars Rebels, already learning stuff about how to be a good pilot.
Yeah, at the academy. So he's actually academy trained. He wasn't actually Rogue Reader, though, in Empire Strikes Back. He was Rogue 3. Yeah, Luke right. was he Rogue Reader.
Bit of a typo here is the leader of Rogue Squadron.
Yeah, he took over Rogue Squadron right after the Battle of Hoth because Luke left to do Jedi training. So I'll count that as close enough because he does end up being...
She's only wrong by a few hours.
Plus, you know, I talked about Poe feeling like a video game character. Wedge generally is the video game character that you play as in the Rogue Squadron series, which is part of the reason I love piloting in the Star Wars universe in the first place. Mm-hmm. Not sure how I was good at those games. I tried playing Squadrons recently and really bad at that.
Flight simulators have advanced a great deal, and our reflexes may have not.
That's true, but also Rogue Squadron is more of an arcade style than a flight simulator, whereas Squadrons is more of the flight simulator, so I don't really have any good experience in that. But yeah, I love the Rogue Squadron games back in the day with Wedge. He's another one that I'm a little surprised isn't a little higher on the list. He was involved in blowing up two Death Stars. And unlike Luke, it wasn't about the Force. And piloting through that second Death Star, going through all those tight corners, that takes a lot of skill just to get to the main generator.
Yeah. And also, he's one, like she said, though, he's one of the few characters who isn't named Solo or Skywalker to survive through all three movies, but yet also be involved in the big battles.
In all three movies. Yeah, he was Battle of Yavin, Battle of Hoth, and Battle of Endor. And I don't think... I don't think there's anyone else who does that.
Who isn't one of the mains. Yeah.
Well, even the mains, Luke flew in the Battle of Yavin and the Battle of Hoth, but he was on the Death Star at the Battle of Endor, so he wasn't piloting. Han only piloted in the Battle of Yavin. Lando wasn't in the Battle of Yavin at all. Leia's not a pilot. Chewbacca wasn't piloting at Hoth or Endor. Yeah. Yeah, he's actually the only one who was in all three of those battles and survived. The only one who was in all three of those battles at all. But he survived them all.
Good job, Wedge. You're the man. All right. Number three.
And came back in Rise of Skywalker.
Yes, that was so great.
He's a gunner too.
Yeah. All right. Number three. This is someone that you've constantly guessed, so please go ahead and guess her one more time.
All right. Well, I'm going to guess Hera.
Yes, it is Hera Syndulla, she of the green Twi'lek fame and Rebels fame. Hera Syndulla grew up during the Clone Wars, so when the time came to take a side, she joined the Rebel Alliance and fought to restore the Galactic Republic. She organized her own small Rebel force aboard her ship, the Ghost, and it was so effective that it drew the patronage of Senator Bail Organa. Hera and her piloting skills, not only as a stealthy freighter pilot, but also as a deadly and agile fighter, continued to be a thorn in the side of the Empire right up until their final defeat. And beyond, as we have seen now on Ahsoka. I agree completely. Hera definitely deserves this spot on this list. My only counterpoint for a number three, again, would have been perhaps Rey Skywalker. But I will go ahead and spoil 2 and 1 by telling you that Rey is not on this list. So according to this writer, Rey is number 9 in the pilot rank at the very least, at the most.
At best, yeah.
Yeah.
So we've only got 2 left.
So who do you think? Well, this was a surprise to me, but it's accurate.
All right. Well,
number 2.
I'm going to save Anakin/Vader as number 1. So for number 2, I'm going to go with my other Millennium Falcon here. Maybe you can tell the difference if you look at the radar dishes. And you know why they had to have the square one in the new movies? Because Lando's not actually the second best pilot in the galaxy. He broke that thing off at the second Death Star. But I am guessing Lando Calrissian for his maneuver at the Battle of Tanab and at the second Death Star.
That's a good guess, but it's not Lando, and it's not even a classic trilogy character. But we're keeping it in the family with your whole Rey, Anakin, Luke thing. It's Kylo Ren. Number two is Kylo Ren. So unsurprisingly, I disagree with that opener because I was surprised. Unsurprisingly, Han Solo's son and Anakin's grandson would be one of the best pilots in the Star Wars universe. He combines the best of both worlds with his formal training mixed with a creative technique. His ship was the TIE Fighter Silencer, a prototype that cleared the way for the First Order to upgrade their flight systems and become even more lethal in combat. The scene in The Force Awakens that features Kylo Ren attacking the Alliance fleet also features his unique TIE Fighter design. And then in The Last Jedi, we see him doing stuff in the TIE Silencer when he launches the missiles that blow up the hangars and whatnot.
The hangars.
Not the bridge. He was hesitating, but he had blown up pieces of the ship before that with extreme prejudice. So he was not above blasting to pieces part of the Reddit. He didn't pull the trigger on blowing up the bridge because he knew that his mom was there. And he reached out to the Force and was aware of her presence. And then two other First Order pilots fired the shot that blew up the bridge.
Yeah, and then we do see him piloting in The Rise of Skywalker, where he manages to lose to Rey, who was not in a ship because she jumped over him and cut off a wing. Yeah.
What? Attacking starfighters with a lightsaber? That's so unheard of. Ahsoka did that.
Yeah, and that's one of my least favorite parts of the Ahsoka show so far. For the same reasons I didn't like it in Rise of Skywalker, I don't think it makes a ton of sense.
Interestingly, Kylo was not flying the TIE Silencer when he was down there on the planet chasing Rey in the Rise of Skywalker.
It was a different TIE, wasn't it?
Kylo Ren was piloting at that time was a different kind of TIE fighter. It was almost like a revamp version 2.0 TIE Interceptor.
Yeah.
As the Silencer had that squarish cockpit that was almost more like they had took pieces of the Lambda-class shuttle and put them in a blender with the original TIE Advanced and kind of spun them together. I'll try spinning. That's a good trick. And they came up with the TIE Silencer. Very cool-looking ship. Probably my favorite thing that Kylo Ren flew. But in this case, we saw him flying some sort of mixed-up TIE Interceptor. And then, of course, we get to see him, or it's implied, that he pilots a regular old TIE LN at the end of The Rise of Skywalker when he has become Ben Solo once again and is flying to meet Rey and company on Exegol so we can have the very picturesque and poetic moment of Red 5 and a regular TIE fighter parked side by side as both of those entities, both of those sides of the old war, have joined together to finally defeat Palpatine and the Sith Empire once and for all.
Yeah, this one surprises me.
Me too.
I wouldn't have put him on the list, quite frankly. Honestly, I would have put like Jango Fett above Kylo Ren. Or Boba. Yeah, or Boba. Either one of them. I'm surprised he's on the list. I didn't have a model for him anyway, but even if I had, I don't think I would have grabbed it.
She makes a pretty good case here by referencing the stuff that he did as a pilot on screen. I mean, he was killing resistance pilots. He blew up chunks of the capital ships. He's able to fly to Exegol in a regular old TIE fighter, although she didn't actually mention that by name, but she implied. I can see it. I think for me, my personal category or catalog of pilots in Star Wars is still heavily influenced by the piloting skill referenced in the old Star Wars CCG from Decipher. Mm-hmm. And in the most recent, or not most recent, but in the initial version of Kylo Ren that was released from the fan community, he didn't have a pilot icon at all. He was only doing stuff on the ground. So
because he mainly doesn't pilot things. I mean, he can. He's not bad at it, but it's not his main shtick. And I don't think that he's that much better than the other pilots around him. I do think he's better, but that's because he's got the Force. I expect him to be better. So would I, if I made a list that was long enough, I would get to him and say, he is a good pilot. But I would not have jumped to his name
Yeah.
For
I think, top and I think she 10. Actually has a little bit of a typo here when she says his TIE silencer was in The Force Awakens. I actually think that wasn't unveiled until The Last Jedi.
I think you're right.
I'm trying to remember. Yeah, I think
she. Yeah, and she mentioned fighting against the fleet, but that was also The Last Jedi. That was not The Force Awakens.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, and then number one is exactly who you have been expecting it to be.
Yes, because if we go back to the Star Wars CCG, he's the only one who added 4 power to the ship that he flew if it was Black One, or excuse me, Vader's custom TIE. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Darth Vader, Anakin Skywalker, well known as a great star pilot. He was a great pilot even when Obi-Wan first met him. Of course, Obi-Wan is talking from a certain point of view because he's talking about piloting pod racers, not spaceships.
Yeah, once again, we must stretch the English language. I mean, the common language, galactic standard language to its breaking point with Obi-Wan saying, when I first met him, he was a great star pilot. As a 9-year-old kid, interpolated as his skill at a pod racing. Anyway, so here we go. If Ben Kenobi called him the best star pilot in the galaxy, then it must be true. It's possible that old Ben was trying to warm up to young Luke by flattering his father, but Anakin did have some impressive moves, even as a kid with a glorified go-kart. How dare you? Anyway, it seems that He's out of line, but he's not wrong. Anyway, it seems that Anakin didn't lose his skills as a pilot after becoming Darth Vader either. When things get tense during the attack on the first Death Star, he gets into his own TIE fighter, a decision that ultimately saves his life. So there you have it. I have no arguments with number one being Anakin.
He also shows up in Rebels and attacks the fleet with just his TIE fighter and just absolutely, like, casually, you're gonna die now. You know what? Now I feel like killing you. You guys are all shooting at me. No big deal. None of you are gonna hit me.
He is
an incredible pilot, definitely deserving of the top spot. Has the best reputation, and we didn't see too much of it in the movies. Especially in the original trilogy, we only see him at the Battle of Yavin. But you know, even then, he takes out several starfighters, almost kills Wedge. What other Imperial can say that?
Right, exactly. So yeah, absolutely agree with number one. Fun list, way better than the previous listicles
that we've done. Yeah, the main quibble I have with it is Kylo Ren. I don't think I would have put him on that list.
I wouldn't have put him in the top 8, much less at number 2.
Yeah, I think Rey would have been better in the top 8. Honestly, I could probably find a few others. Well, like we mentioned, Jango or Boba, I think also would have been better choices than Kylo. But everybody else, I might quibble a little bit with the placements. I'd put Poe a little bit higher. But overall, yeah, I think we have 7 good choices and 1 question mark. And that's not bad.
Well, speaking of great choices, it's time to do Derek's favorite part of the show. What Star Wars t-shirt have you chosen to wear this week, Nathan?
I have chosen to wear my Nintendo-inspired Grogu This Is The Way t-shirt.
That's great.
Based on the old 8-bit Nintendo games, the cartridges were that size taller than they were wide. I remember those old cartridges and the old boxes those cartridges came in.
Yeah.
Because that was my first, well, technically that was my second gaming system. I did have an Atari before that.
Nice.
But I don't remember too much about the Atari other than we played a game that I called Frogger that was not Frogger.
That was my 4th gaming system, but this is not a video gaming retro podcast. Instead, I will tell you that...
Even though we talked about Squadrons, Rogue Squadron, and NES games.
Yeah. Oh.
Maybe we should do an episode about that. Anyway. We
compared parts of Poe Dameron's flight expertise to video
games. All right. Well, I see what t-shirt you are wearing, and I am very happy to see this come out of mothballs. And I hope it has no moth holes in it.
We are recording on October 1st, so the official beginning of spooky season. So I'm wearing my Star Wars Stormtrooper, OG Galactic Civil War Stormtrooper helmet, but he's made up of little tiny orange jack-o'-lantern pumpkins. So it's a Star Wars Stormtrooper helmet that is a mosaic of jack-o'-lanterns. So he's orange and black on my gray t-shirt to celebrate Halloween, making its triumphant return for this year. You know, Star Wars and Halloween have had a long association as kids the world over have dressed up as some kind of Star Wars character for Halloween or trick-or-treat or some sort of masquerade ball and so on and so forth.
And I want to throw out there, kids of all ages.
That's right. Absolutely. I know I have dressed as a Star Wars character more than once on many a Halloween. Although, ironically, during the 1980s, I didn't do a lot of Star Wars costumes. I usually would do something related to ghosts or goblins or whatnot. Probably my most famous Star Wars or Halloween costume that wasn't Star Wars was a Ghostbuster. But I had to make all the stuff by hand because this was long before they sold any kind of like props and replica and whatnot back in the day. I took some old shoeboxes and taped them to the back of a gray members only jacket and then decorated the shoeboxes in various levels to look like a proton pack. And I took a spark gun that I had, cut off the barrel so that the sparks would fly directly out the end of the gun, and then connected it to the pack with an old coily telephone wire.
Wow.
It was that, so much
that's
fun.
That's impressive.
And yeah, people knew immediately what I was trying to do and actually stopped me to take pictures, which nobody did back then because, you know, pictures were much more of a hassle.
I didn't get into Star Wars until I was a little too old to go trick-or-treating, so I never wore a Star Wars costume. I do remember being Oscar the Grouch one time when I was like 4 or 5 years old.
Nice.
I do remember also once being a newsboy with the hat, the button down hat,
page boy cap,
and yep. Yeah, and the and knickers and like a bag that I could carry newspapers around in. I don't remember why, but like that year, I just like, this is the costume I want to do.
Perhaps and my parents were near the release of Newsies, the film.
No, I definitely did not see Newsies until.
Well, that doesn't mean that you recently. Weren't aware of it.
Maybe like subconsciously, I guess. Mm-hmm. I don't know, but my parents were like, "Are you sure?" I'm like, "Yes, this is definitely what I want to do."
See, and I was going to say, once again, retro video gaming, I was going to say, well, Paperboy, the video game. But then in that game, he doesn't look a thing like what you just described.
But so, I did play Paperboy at the time, so yeah, that didn't look may like have that. Influenced it.
He was like on a bike with the backwards ball cap.
Yeah. Yeah, but maybe the fact that it was Paperboy made me think of that and like, oh, well, I could do this as an homage to it. I don't know. It was a long time ago anyway.
Indeed. Well, if you guys out there listening want to get your own cool What a Piece of Junk t-shirt or, you know, mouse pad or iPad case or coffee mug, you can, of course, check out
this from GameStop. But yeah.
Yeah. You can, of course, go check out our store at tpublic.com where you can find our merchandise as well as merchandise from any of the other awesome FPN shows. And speaking of awesome shows, if you think our show is awesome, please leave us a rating on one of the rating services out there. And if you're curious as to where you can find our show, Nathan is about to tell you about all the places where you can find us on the interwebs.
You can find us pretty much anywhere you get podcasts. So that would include Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Podbean, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Google Play, and now we are on YouTube as well. On Facebook, you can find us. Our page is What a Piece of Junk, a Star Wars podcast. You can email us, whatapieceofjunkpod@gmail.com. On Twitter, we're at What Wars. On Instagram, you can follow the entire Fandom Podcast Network at Fandom Podcast Network. No points for creativity with us, but at least we're easy to find. And as Scott said, if you do consume our media anywhere that allows you ratings, particularly on Apple Podcasts, we would love for you to give us a review. Let us know what you think we did well, what we could do better. And, you know, if you give us a 5-star review, that can help other people find our podcast. So we would love for you to do that. Plus, we don't want to get exiled to Peridia, and 5-star reviews might help with that not happening too.
Yeah, we don't want to land in the land of dreams and madness.
Mm-mm.
Well, anyway, we want to thank you all for joining us. And as always, we want to remind you to please respect each other and always respect each other's fandom. All right, Nathan, punch it.